How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
WBEZ's nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
Russia and China are no fans of his, and Egypt wouldn't even let him in the country. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. As the executive director of Human Rights Watch, Kenneth Roth spent 30 years investigating and standing up to the world's most ruthless oppressors. During that time, he exposed war crimes, confronted authoritarian regimes, and on more than one occasion found himself in the crosshairs. We sat down with Roth to discuss his new book, Righting Wrongs, 3 decades on the front lines battling abusive governments. He talked about the lessons he learned about justice and the ongoing battle to uphold our most basic values. He started things off with how he sees the role that Human Rights Watch plays in the world.
The reason I wrote this book is that when people recognize that I fight for human rights, they say, you know, oh, isn't that nice? You know, I'm for human rights too. But they kind of have this view that it's ineffectual, you know, it's a nice thing to stand for, but you can't really make any difference.
Mm-hmm.
And what I wanted to show with this book is that defending human rights is not a matter of, you know, holding the candle and singing kumbaya. It is a matter of playing hardball. We put pressure on governments and we try to change the cost-benefit analysis behind repression. Governments, you know, have their reasons to violate human rights as a way to stay in power.
Yeah.
We want to make that more costly. And so what I do with this book is to give example after example of how we pushed back, how we made a difference. And through pulling back the curtain on these strategies, I want to make it easier for people to understand how they, too, can help to promote human rights.
Mm-hmm. Where do you think that kumbaya image comes from? Why do people think that that's all it is?
You know, I think there is this view of activism as just, you know, holding a picket or you know, doing things that are sort of more a statement of the activist than something that really puts pressure on the target.
Yeah.
And that's not what Human Rights Watch does. You know, Human Rights Watch really figures out what does the target government care about and how do we deprive them of that until they change. And a lot of times it's the reputation. So
yeah.
The bread and butter of what we do is to, you know, investigate, document, and report on government abuse. And, you know, everybody these days pretends to respect human rights. They obviously fall short. And when we spotlight that difference between pretense and practice, that's, you know, embarrassing and delegitimizing. So governments hate it. But we also figure out, well, you know, what do they want from the international community? And it's always something, you know, it's arms sales, a military aid package,
mm-hmm.
preferential trade benefits, you know, sometimes just being invited to a fancy summit where they can be photographed with respected leaders and show the folks back home that I'm respected too.
Yeah.
You know? And we go to, you know, allied governments and say, don't give this to the target government until they change. And that can be very powerful.
Yeah, human rights organizations, they're not the world court. They aren't sovereign nations. You can't impose or sanction. You can't impose an embargo or sanction. But when it comes to leverage, you write in the book, quote, shaming plays an important role in the defense of human rights. Why is shaming such a powerful tool?
Well, when I say shaming, some people misunderstand it to think that, you know, I want the abusive leader to feel guilty. And that's not what it's about. You know, dictators have very little remorse. I'm not in the psychology business. I'm not trying to convert them. But rather, because, you know, every dictator has to pretend to serve their people, which basically means respecting their human rights, they need to put on these airs that they actually uphold these standards. And when we show that they fall short, that is embarrassing. It's shameful. And, you know, because that, in a sense, weakens the dictator's grasp on power, they push back. And it's a predictable pattern. You know, they lie, they deny, they say we're biased. But because we're very careful, very accurate, we win those battles. And ultimately, they recognize that they're not going to get rid of the bad press until they change the bad conduct. That's when we make progress.
Mm-hmm. You cover many countries in righting wrongs, as well as the United Nations. I'm curious how you decided which campaigns would make it into the book.
Well, what I wanted to do was to take on the hardest cases, because I wanted to show that the human rights movement can make a difference even there. And so I took on China. You know, I took on Russia and particularly its conduct in Syria. Mm-hmm. I looked at Rwanda in eastern Congo.
And that's how you divide the book too, right? Each chapter is based on the country.
Yes. And then I have certain chapters that are kind of broader thematic. I talk about how we actually moved the U.S. government to change the way it fought wars. You know, I talk about how, despite U.S. opposition, we helped to secure the International Criminal Court. But I wanted to take on the really tough, big battles and show how we move things forward.
It's a tough time, and I wonder how you think we get through numbness. We see lots of images sometimes online, social media. I'm thinking of the war in Gaza, for instance, and just the constant, you know, barrage of images of what's happening to children there, and facts and reports. When those things no longer seem to be moving people, how do you get through that numbness?
Well, that's part of what I wanted to accomplish with this book, is to show that, you know, even in dire situations, there are things you can do to improve the situation. And, you know, in Gaza, I mean, yes, people are appalled and then appalled again, and there's a limit to that. But I do think that that global outrage has made a difference. You know, it helped to push Israel finally to agree to a ceasefire. Periodically, it opened up the gates for humanitarian aid and interrupted Israel's starvation strategy in Gaza. It is what persuaded Biden to suspend delivery of these huge 2,000-pound bombs that the Israeli government was using indiscriminately to decimate neighborhoods. Mm. So, you know, around the margins, it made a difference. The International Criminal Court made clear that this was beyond the pale. That's why it charged Netanyahu and the former defense minister, Gallant. So these are efforts to reaffirm the standards. And obviously the big question now is, you know, how do we move forward? And they're very different visions. I mean, Trump, you know, wants to solve the Israeli-Palestinian problem by getting rid of the Palestinians. That's sort of the far-right Israeli dream. Fortunately, everybody else, you know, the entire Arab world and most of the global public say, no way, that would be a crime against humanity. We're not going to underwrite that.
So what about when showing war crimes isn't enough? Are there other points of leverage that you find?
Well, for example, I tell the story of the Rwandan government's support for this awful rebel group, the M23, in eastern Congo. And a decade ago, how Rwanda basically invaded eastern Congo via this proxy force. Showing the atrocities of what the M23, what it was committing, wasn't enough. We had to enlist at that stage the U.S. and the British governments. And former U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, former British Foreign Secretary William Hague, called Rwandan President Paul Kagame and said, if you don't stop this, your aid is cut off. And within days, the M23 crumbled. And Eastern Congo lived for about 8 years without the predation of the M23. It now is back. And I get into the book, you know, why it's back and why we need similar intense pressure on Kagame, which has not yet been forthcoming.
You said you intentionally chose some of the campaigns that were the most challenging. Were there moments throughout the decades, Kenneth, when you felt hopeless or you questioned your approach?
You know, maybe it's you know, a fault of mine, but I don't feel hopeless. I look at every situation and the challenge is to figure out how can you make it better. And there is always something. There's always an angle. And what you have to do is figure out, you know, what does the leader care about? I mean, that's why I opened the book into a discussion of Idlib, the northwestern Syrian province, which at the time was the last part of the country held by the armed opposition. And this seemed to be an impossible situation because Assad, the Syrian president, was absolutely brutal. He used chemical weapons, barrel bombs. He did everything imaginable and was really beyond shaming. And so we had to figure out, how do we stop this guy? And our strategy that we developed was to focus on Vladimir Putin, mm-hmm. who at that point was still shameable because he had not yet launched the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And working at that point with German Chancellor Angela Merkel, with French President Emmanuel Macron, and with the people around Turkish President Erdogan, we put enough pressure on Putin that starting in March 2020, the bombing of hospitals and schools and marketplaces and apartment buildings stopped. And the people of Idlib lived for 3 years with no bombing. It's picked up a little bit, and now it's over with definitively because Idlib is where this rebel group came from that overthrew Assad. So I think it's a good illustration how, you know, even when it seems impossible, there are things you can do.
Yeah, a key part of your strategy was, you know, working with European leaders. So then what do you make of the apparent realignment with the U.S. turning from longtime European allies?
I mean, I have to say, I'm appalled that Trump is cozying up to Putin and that he seems to value Putin's autocracy more than Europe's liberal democracy. And, you know, you can go into the psychology of that. I mean, he seems to admire Putin's ability to operate without checks and balances on his authority. He seems to, you know, admire Putin's rejection of liberal values.
Yeah, I think we saw this coming, right?
Yes. No, I mean, he signaled this in his first term. So this isn't that much of a surprise. I do think there's a real challenge for Europe to step up to the plate now, to bolster its military, to really, you know, come to the defense of Ukraine. But I also haven't entirely given up on Trump because, you know, Trump sees himself as a master deal maker. And if the deal he produces in Ukraine is just a temporary ceasefire that allows Putin to rearm and reinvade and to proceed with his plan to destroy Ukraine's democracy so it no longer serves as a model for Russians, that will be a failure. He will be seen as the Neville Chamberlain of the 21st century. He will be seen as a bad deal maker. And frankly, it's only going to be with a U.S. backstop to European security guarantees that a lasting peace can be put in place in Ukraine. So I still hope that we can appeal to Trump's mm-hmm. self-image to push him, maybe for the wrong reasons, to do the right thing.
Speaking of Trump, did you finish writing this book before or after you knew the results of the 2024 presidential election?
I mean, this is the problem with writing books. You know, the book was essentially done.
It was
done. Long before that. Now, I was able to put in one or two lines reflecting that Trump had won, but I wasn't able to make
any modifications. Yeah, I wondered if you would have done anything differently had you known the results.
Well, I mean, the essence of the book really remains, you know, because the book is an outline for how you take on the tough cases and you figure out how to move it forward. And so I think the lessons that I really try to teach with the book are completely applicable to Trump today.
Yeah. You investigate some of the worst crimes in the world from some of the most powerful nations. Do you have a copy-paste approach no matter the country, or do you find you've got to come up with unique strategies or, you know, targeted strategies depending on which country you happen to be investigating at the time?
I mean, it's a little bit of each. The beginning is almost always the same, which is send an investigator into the country, document as carefully and objectively as you can what's happening, and publicize that. And then try to, you know, begin with shaming. But after that, it really varies country to country because each time you got to figure out, you know, what does this leader want? And that changes from leader to leader. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, how do you prevent them from getting it? You know, how do you mount a pressure campaign against this leader? That's unique with each situation. And that's the very creative part of the job.
Let's go back to your childhood, Kenneth. You grew up here in Deerfield, Illinois.
I did indeed.
So how would you say this region has shaped you?
Well, I mean, what really shaped me was my father's experience before he got to Deerfield. He got to Deerfield because it was like a safe place and his upbringing was not the least bit safe.
He fled Nazi Germany.
Precisely. He was he fled as a 12-year-old boy in July 1938 from Frankfurt. And so I grew up with Hitler stories. You know, I grew up very aware of the evil the governments could do, in this case to a young Jewish boy. And I think that played a big part in my desire to try to prevent such atrocities from recurring. You know, and I had, you know, funny little minimalist political experiences. My father, you know, was the president of the school board in Deerfield. So, you know, he used me and my brothers and sister as his child labor campaigning team. You know, so I had, you know, early introductions to politics, but at a very, you know, simple local level. And it didn't, you know, growing up in Deerfield didn't push me in an international direction, but my father's experience did.
This work is incredibly, is grueling. You write in the text here about emotional detachment and how that sort of allowed you to keep doing this decade after decade. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I contrast myself with my wife, who is a doctor and a public health professional. And she gets very emotionally involved, you know, with her patients, but also with these kinds of issues that she also works on. And I took a different approach. And I am obviously moved by the plight of people I encounter, but I felt that to do my job well, I needed to maintain kind of an analytic objectivity. And I needed, you know, even in dire situations, to be able to figure out, okay, where do we move forward from here? Mm-hmm. And so this, you know, it reflects who I am, but it also, in a sense, paralleled what the organization Human Rights Watch became, in that we don't get things done by just saying, oh, let's express solidarity with the victims. We got things done by expressing outrage at the perpetrators and putting pressure on them to change. And that is sort of, I think it was strategically smart to do that, but it also psychologically enabled me to do this work. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I would be in a horrible situation, but I would figure out, what can I do to make this better? And there was always something, and having that purpose kept me going.
You faced criticism, though, from various governments and political groups. In fact, some have even put a target on your back and see you as an enemy. So how do you handle that pressure and pushback when really powerful actors are trying to just discredit human rights work?
Well, I mean, that's a hazard of the trade. I mean, I've been personally sanctioned by both the Chinese and the Russian governments.
Right.
And I wear that as a badge of honor. But, I mean, to answer your question, this is where the care that Human Rights Watch takes made it easy to do the job. Because we're always attacked. You know, no government likes Human Rights Watch reports. And so we were just certain that they were accurate, that they were objective, that they fairly applied human rights principles the same way in 100 countries around the world where we worked. And so when Human Rights Watch issued something and we were attacked, I felt very comfortable defending it because I knew we were right. And the attack was just part of the government's effort to deflect attention to their horrible human rights practices. So I kind of relished the battles because I knew that this was how we moved governments, and I knew that I would emerge from them on the top because we were right and they were covering up what was wrong.
You know, this country often promotes itself as sort of a champion of human rights. Yet we have watched over the years as the U.S. has been criticized for its actions in other places like Iraq, Guantanamo Bay, its recent handling of migrants. So how do you think that America can begin to restore its record and better align that with its rhetoric?
Well, I mean, you're completely right that U.S. support for human rights, both in its own practices and in its foreign policy, is very inconsistent. The U.S., you know, can be a very powerful force for human rights when we've had a government behind us on a certain issue. It makes a big difference. But that hypocrisy really undermines U.S. credibility. And then, you know, today, I mean, the Trump administration is not even pretending to support human rights. So they're kind of out of the picture. They're AWOL. Now, we lived through this before. I mean, the first Bush administration, or George W. Bush, you know, as you note, was torturing people, throwing people endlessly in Guantanamo. Mm-hmm. You know, it also had no credibility on human rights. Trump, in his first term, pulled out of the battle. He left the UN Human Rights Council, which people just don't even do. So we've learned how to build global coalitions of governments to support human rights, even when the important U.S. voice is not there.
I see.
And I tell stories in the book about how some of our biggest global victories were against the United States. For example, we shared the Nobel Peace Prize for securing a treaty banning anti-personnel landmines. The U.S. opposed us. We similarly banned cluster munitions without U.S. support. We helped to create the International Criminal Court with the U.S. dead set against us, and they were outvoted 120-7.
Mm-hmm.
So I describe what it took to do that. And what we found over time is that if you build, you know, coalitions of roughly 60 governments, you know, small and medium-sized democracies from around the world, they have the moral authority to prevail even without the superpowers. And the U.S., you know, along with Russia and China, opposed us on every one of these ventures, and each one we won.
After decades in this field, Kenneth, do you still believe in the power of advocacy and public pressure to bring about meaningful change?
Oh, I totally believe it.
Yeah.
I mean, I hope people cannot read my book without coming away understanding the power of advocacy. Because, you know, and one lesson I really try to convey is that this is not just about moving governments. This can be about, you know, moving your university, moving a corporation. I mean, moving, you know, any institution where the public has a sense of right and wrong about how they should behave. And that gives, you know, activists, really anybody, the power to move them.
Mm-hmm.
And I very much believe in that, that, you know, in a sense, what we're doing is forcing powerful institutions to live up to public expectations about right and wrong. And that is a tool that all of us has at our disposal.
So what advice then do you give young activists or those looking to do work in human rights advocacy?
Well, in terms of human rights advocacy, I mean, I think the most important thing people can do is spend some time outside of the United States, you know,
yes.
Learn a language.
Travel.
Travel, yes. But, you know, more broadly than not, people ask me today, well, you know, what can I do as an individual? These are such big global issues. And this is where I come back to the power of the human rights movement ultimately rests on public morality, on, you know, what the public sees as right or wrong. If a government does something even awful, but the public applauds, we won't be able to change that very effectively. But if the public frowns upon what's going on, we can move the government. And so even just an ordinary person can help to build that public morality, because people trust most these days their friends, their families, mm-hmm. their coworkers. And so just speaking around the dinner table, you know, speaking during the coffee break, posting on social media helps to reinforce the public morality that is needed to hold governments to account.
Kenneth Roth is the author of Righting Wrongs, 3 decades on the Front Lines Battling Abusive Governments. The book is available wherever books are sold. Kenneth, thank you so much.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Meha Ahmed, Linnea Dominic, and me. It was edited by Dan Tucker and also mixed by Meha. Make sure to always join in on the conversation by hitting subscribe or finding us at wbez.org/reset. Thanks so much for listening. We'll meet again soon.
I love how WBEZ shows different sides of the story. I never feel like it's too polarized, and I think the reporters do an excellent job of trying to get the full story, trying to show different other sides. I'm often, when I'm listening to public radio, think in my mind, well, what about X? Or like, I have another question. Or like, have they thought about X? And most of the time, WBEZ thinks about all of it, which I really appreciate.